We're now prepared to hear argument in the second case of the day, the United States versus Alvear et al. So, Mr. Walrath, you lead off.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jim Walrath appearing. The first of four defendant appellant lawyers to tag team the government this morning. My client is Rodolfo Madrigal. I think the overall point that all of us wanted to convey, both through our joint brief and in our individual or supplemental briefs, was that a number of major issues arose during this trial, which, of course, we say are grounds for appeal and reversal, when perhaps, maybe not individually, would provide grounds for reversible error, but cumulatively do. The two I want to speak to deal with the admission of not gang membership evidence so much, but gang activity evidence, although certainly I think a fair characterization of the way the case started, that the government was offering, claimed to be offering it really as gang membership evidence. But it stretched on and far more detailed in terms of what it really was. The other issue I want to address in my remarks, at least on, in my opening remarks, relates to the insertion of a totally irrelevant issue or matter, and that is the matter of race in the remarks of the defendants as they appeared in the recorded conversations, the undercover taped recording conversations, and in the wiretaps. In terms of looking at this, in terms of whether the admission of those two lines of evidence created prejudice, and I'm not, this morning, given the limitations of time, I'm not going to argue what's already in the briefs as far as how the courts are really encourage everyone to shy away from gang evidence, if possible, and racially inflammatory references in the record for fear of prejudice. So the rules are there, the pronouncements are there from this court on those two points and on those two issues. But the overview I hope this court will have in deciding this appeal relates to the way the government really brought its case, both in the indictment and then followed it up with the evidence. The core evidence in this case was of drug dealing by Defendant Tejeda and Defendant Alvear. Defendants Madrigal, Delgado Rios, and Malero really are kind of attached to this larger and concentrated scheme of distribution by Tejeda and Alvear through telephone counts. In other words, in the 19-count indictment in which the conspiracy count was the first count, there are five substantive distribution counts against Tejeda, four possession counts against Tejeda, two attempted possession counts against Tejeda, three possession counts against Alvear, three attempted possession counts against Alvear. What do we have against Madrigal, Delgado Rios, and Malero, other than their allegation that they also were involved in the conspiracy? We have telephone counts, that they were using a phone to somehow facilitate a transaction. It seems to me that's a red flag right there, that it is likely that the defense will want to explore, and in fact did in these cases, whether those defendants were conspirators or were they occasional or even periodic buyers from the Tejeda LVR operation, but not conspirators. The evidence that came in, pretty much, if you try to look at it in an overview, matched what the indictment reflected. That is, there was core evidence of dealing by Tejeda and Alvear, especially in the undercover buy recordings by the confidential informants. Seven instances on tape of sales of cocaine by Tejeda. One specific tape-recorded conversation of possession with intent to deliver by Tejeda and Alvear. And one attempted possession on tape by Tejeda and Alvear. Comparatively, you don't have that kind of evidence against these other defendants. The government then attempts to shore up this tape-recorded evidence by using cooperating witnesses, including Andres Lopez and Carlos Escalante and Carlos Oliveras. A quick summary of their role in the government's case. Lopez testifies at length about Tejeda and Alvear dealing with each other and how Lopez would store cocaine for Tejeda, he would deliver for him. But when it comes to Lopez's testimony about Malero and Madrigal and Delgado Rios, it was that they were buying. They were buyers from the Tejeda Alvear operation. And in fact, as to Madrigal, Lopez could offer evidence that he knew of one occasion only where Madrigal bought from Tejeda. Then the evidence gets into this drug robbery material, because and that goes to the sentencing issues that other counsel will raise. But that's where the government tries to up the ante, so to speak, or say the evidence ups the ante in terms of the amount of drugs involved. I'm surprised to see that my time has run so quickly.
You're into
that. I understand.
It's all your time, but
I understand it. So I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal, as I indicated to the clerk's office. My overall point is that if you look at the way the Escalante evidence came in, in which there was this incredible emphasis using him to show how the gang operated, who held positions, what the positions were, that they bought firearms, that they used drug money to post bond, that they even paid for lawyers' fees. Of course, they didn't pay for the lawyers in this case, but the jury didn't get to hear that.
Where the?
And an interesting little facet of this whole thing. But ultimately, it came to be that the gang evidence, even according to the government's brief to this court at page 25, it really was propensity evidence. The government's brief at 25 says, because the Latin Kings, being an organization whose principal income was derived from drug dealing, made it more likely that these men participated in a conspiracy. I don't know how you can characterize that other than to be a statement that it was the propensity of these defendants to engage in drug activity because they are said to have belonged to the Latin homeboys and the Latin Kings. I think I'll try to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you,
Mr. Waller. Mr. Clavelli.
Thank you, Your Honors. Counsel for the defendants, counsel for the government. May it please this honorable court. Your Honors, I represent Delgado Rios. He received the minimum sentence of 120 months because it was obvious from the evidence that he was really nothing but a buyer to this conspiracy. Even the government didn't attempt to up the drug quantity beyond the fact that the jury, in a special verdict, found above 5 kilos, and that was because of this alleged drug robbery of 4 kilos, which affected everybody in this case. I'd like to state to the court that upon my client's arrest, he gave a complete post-arrest statement. Everything in that statement was true. Nothing in that statement was shown to not be true. He said he bought $20 at a time because he was a user. He also collected a few drug debts for Mr. Tejeda, which the surveillance certainly showed. He seemed walking away with a piece of paper on two of the four occasions he was surveyed. His house was searched twice, once when he was arrested with his consent, and once about 6 months earlier, after a ruse traffic arrest, he gave him permission to search. They found one $20 bag when he was arrested. They found nothing the time before, and they found no drug paraphernalia, no baggies, no mix, no nothing, which was found in some other people's places. The only two witnesses testified really about my client. The main witness, Lopez, who never had a direct conversation with him, but talked about hearing from Mr. Saul Tejeda in statements which should not have been admitted under 801 D2E because they're after the fact, not in furtherance of any conspiracy. The foundation was woefully weak in all of the Santiago proffer and in the co-conspirators' exception statements that were allowed as non-hearsay. And he claimed, Mr. Lopez claimed, that seeing and overhearing four conversations in 2002, that he surmised that my client was purchasing between an eighth of an ounce and 2 ounces of cocaine every few weeks, all through 2002 and 2003. I got to think the jury discounted that because it was really so ridiculous. But he talked about the drug robbery also, and that came from Mr. Tejeda after the fact. The person that really hurt my client was his cousin, Heriberto Rios. But Mr. Rios totally shuts down Mr. Lopez because he introduces Saul Tejeda, and this is alleged in the indictment, because he's not a gang member. He is a close family associate. And that is in spring of 04. So here Lopez is talking about sales in 02 and 03. They didn't even exist. Because Mr. Lopez basically said whatever was convenient. But the thing that hurt my client, because Mr. Heriberto Rios did not put a quantity on drug sales because he didn't know. He just knows that my client was a buyer, previously had bought from him. But he knew about a drug robbery, and what he didn't testify on in his examination was that he knew about it from his brother, Miguel Rios, who was not indicted. I waited until the defense case. I called the case agent, Ms. Camacho, who took the 302 information, which was 6 pages long. One paragraph was on this drug robbery, and it concludes, and you can read it for yourselves in, I believe it's my Exhibit D in a footnote, Miguel said he was angry because he didn't receive as much as he thought he should have received. Well, I'm trying to get her to state what is in her report. She doesn't want to do it. She keeps on adding that they both, Heriberto Rito spoke to my client and his brother. But, of course, it doesn't say that. She then says to me, you want me to read it? I say, sure. And that, of course, is Rule 8035, past recollection recorded, if Mr. Heriberto Rios would have adopted it, and that would have said, Miguel said he was angry, not my client. Now, my client said in his post-arrest statement, I'm aware of where drugs were being stored, as was his cousin, because the family knew this guy, but I never participated, I never took anything. And the only one that said he did was Heriberto Rios, and that is 4 kilos. So then, the government calls that a prior consistent statement, but it's a prior inconsistent statement. It's not admissible under 801 D1B, like the government says. The Green case does not support the government's position. And in the Green case, because it was a defendant whose statement was contained in the 302, the judge properly allowed it to be read to the jury because it was a prior consistent statement. Here, it's a prior inconsistent statement. They should have called Heriberto Rios to the witness stand. And then in closing argument, they misstated the facts on that, saying that the witness said both my client and his brother. They told the jury, don't worry about the people you don't see in the courtroom. And they also told the jury that there was a lot more evidence that if they had played all the evidence they had, we'd still be here listening to evidence. And that, to me, was the most egregious error against all the defendants.
I thought this was your witness in your line of questioning? And
I called in the defense case the government's case agent, and she refused to admit what was in her 302.
And so you agreed to have it read?
Yes, and it was not, though. And then the government argument misstated the testimony of the first witness and her.
Okay, I see.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clavelli. Mr. Zaffiro?
Thank you. May it please the court, the little voice that I have today, counsel, United States Attorney. My name is Attorney Richard Zaffiro, and I'm here on behalf of Jose Melero. And I'm here to talk about bifurcation. This is an issue that was raised in this case by motion and ultimately denied. It was error to deny bifurcation in this case. It's certainly available in criminal cases, and I cited the case law on the issue of guilt versus penalty, which is what we have here. Quantity is not an element of the offense. Quantity, on the other hand, is immensely important on sentencing. And the error, which I think demonstrates that it is not harmless error, is stated by Judge Breyer in his dissent in Apprendi and by myself and others in briefs, essentially, I am not guilty. I have a presumption of innocence. I am not guilty of conspiracy. But by the way, if I am, it's not quite that guilty. And that's the bind that these people were put in particular the lesser players in this case, people such as Melero, who on takedown day had some 1,100 grams, and I think he has a total attached to him of 1,150 grams when ultimately he's sentenced on 5 kilos. But requiring him to argue out of both sides of his mouth by not bifurcating it definitely has a substantial injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict. He loses all credibility in front of the jury when he's saying to them, I'm not guilty, but if I am, I'm not that guilty. The problem that every defendant has when you have a unitary proceeding is arguing quantity essentially is a tacit admission of guilt. Why would you even bother with the issue of quantity if you weren't involved in the conspiracy? So you're arguing quantity. But if you don't argue quantity, if you don't argue quantity at all, now you're running the risk of letting quantity wash over you without having fired a shot at the time of sentencing. Bifurcating would have protected against that. He would have avoided the Hobson's choice between self-incriminating in the guilt phase so that he can deal with quantity versus not dealing with quantity and being washed over by all of this other evidence, much like we have in the forfeiture situation, which, by the way, that already was bifurcated in this case, so administrative concerns weren't even present here, that you testify to minimize quantity findings or remain silent and have no say over the issue of quantity. The prejudice caused to defendants by not bifurcating in that regard reduces the government's burden of proof because, once again, this situation of having to talk out of both sides of your mouth like this would cause a jury to believe, a reasonable jury to believe, that it is more likely that you are guilty. On the other hand, you can avoid that whole scenario by simply having a bifurcated proceeding where we first deal with guilt. We don't have to waste court time talking about quantity if we never even know we're going to get to the issue of guilt, because quantity takes up time administratively, and you can have the argument straight up. I was not a member of this conspiracy. And then, now, if he's convicted, now you immediately go to phase two, just like in a death case, just like in a coverage case, an insurance defense, just like in an NGI case with insanity, where now you go to phase two. I'm going to just make one more point and then sit down to reserve my time. But limiting instructions would certainly have helped here. Limiting instructions weren't present. And
were they proposed?
I do not recall. Frankly, I do not recall seeing that from my review of the case, whether or not limiting instructions had been proposed. But once again, whether or not limiting instructions were proposed, bifurcation was proposed, and this prejudice did occur, and this prejudice is substantial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. Mr. Tazze?
Thank you, Your Honor. Court, counsel, Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. We represent the appellant, Saul Tejada, on appeal. Mr. Tejada, as he has been today, was a headliner at the trial of this case and bore the brunt of a great deal of evidence before the court. We, of course, join in the gang reference argument made in the party's joint brief. Mr. Tejada brings a trial issue and two sentencing issues that I hope are fairly straightforward. The trial issue was that the witness was allowed to answer over objection that Mr. Tejada was a convicted felon. We argue that's kind of a big deal for all the reasons that Old Chief and its progeny recite. Juries really shouldn't be allowed for no reason to know that an accused person is a convicted felon. It came up, as the court may recall, as part of an October 2004 search of an apartment shared between Mr. Tejada and his girlfriend. By the time the police got in the door, the girlfriend was there with some wet baggies near the bathroom and no drugs. There was a bottle, or there was a little box of bullets in the house, and of course the police officer testified that they were there. Tejada's trial counsel, in cross-examining the police officer, got into this line of questioning of, well, you found some bullets, there's nothing illegal about that, is it? Is there? And the alert police officer said, well, yeah, sometimes it's illegal for a convicted felon to have them. And the lawyer said, well, this girlfriend doesn't have a felony conviction, does she? So the government, in redirect, says, you know, wait a minute, he's just opened a door. This has created some misleading impression that Tejada doesn't have a felony conviction. And indeed, the government's brief as to this issue says that the misleading thing about the question was, is that the question was asked without revealing that Tejada was a convicted felon, which would lead to a fairly awkward question. That is, does this girlfriend have a felony conviction? And by the way, my client sitting back here is a convicted felon, as we all know. I mean clearly that wasn't how any sort of reasonable examination was going to take place. So our argument is, and really the only evidentiary basis for allowing this question to be answered was the government's proposition that there had been some evidentiary door opened by the question of whether the girlfriend indeed was a convicted felon. And we'd argue that it didn't. There was nothing about the case that made either the bullets or a felony conviction relevant to a jury determination. Tejada wasn't charged with a 922G gun case or a 924C gun case. The jury had no decision to make as regard to bullets and firearms as to Mr. Tejada, and of course not at all as to his status as to a convicted felon. The argument runs into a fair harmless error argument, which we anticipated, but we would argue that was a serious error, that it's one that combined with the gang evidence arguments made in the appellant's joint brief were cumulative and ought to result in a new trial for Mr. Tejada. The sentencing issues were guideline computations. Much to my surprise, I would argue that the drug quantity argument does have some legs. As counsel and perhaps as the court, we get used to this notion that the standard is a preponderance. The judge is entitled to make estimates and rely on witnesses. The standard here is clear error, so shut up and don't argue about your drug quantity. In this case, the government chose to rely exclusively on the testimony of Mr. Lopez in support of its arguments as to drug quantity. As the PSI pointed out, if the court didn't find this to be credible evidence, there's roughly 15 kilograms that could have been attributed to Mr. Tejada. And that included the 10-kilogram attempt of non-existent cocaine that was recorded and described in the brief. The period of time between 2002 and 2005 that consists of the bulk of the extrapolated cocaine held attributable to Mr. Tejada is based on a single statement. It's a statement the government references in its reply brief. It's found at 294 to 295 of the transcript, wherein the question is, during the time you were working for Mr. Tejada, this is posed to Mr. Lopez, what kind of quantity did you see and what did you observe? And he says, well, I observed it weekly, and it varied from a quarter of a kilo up to 2 kilos, period. So I would argue that's sort of a puny horse to ride, you know, this vast period of time and to attribute that vast quantity of cocaine to Mr. Tejada, combined with the notion that when Mr. Lopez was arrested or when his home was searched in June of 2004, his ability and opportunity to observe what happened thereafter was curtailed. I will stand on the role adjustment argument as briefed unless the court has developed some burning question it must have resolved as to that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Dacey.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Fullerton.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll try to address the arguments in the order in which they were given by my opponents this morning. The first point that was made was with regard to the gang evidence that was admitted at trial. And I think the best answer to that argument is to remind the court of what the findings of the district court were with regard to that evidence. And the district court found in ruling on the post-trial motions and, that the evidence was proper as admitted to show the interrelationship among the defendants, especially since this was a conspiracy case. The evidence was limited and did not, in the district court's view, unduly prejudice the defendants. The district court reiterated in ruling on the post-trial motions that it was very aware that there was a potential for prejudice in admitting evidence of gang affiliation or membership, and said that, I know that the evidence could be highly prejudicial if it were not otherwise relevant, but that it thought that in this case it was relevant to the conspiracy charge in the indictment.
But it was hardly limited. There was a vast amount of this evidence.
It was limited in terms of what the evidence, what the government went into, in terms of the activities of the Latin Kings outside of, say, these defendants' acts of violence or other gratuitous, prejudicial matters that were out there, in fact, but the government...
Why was it important or relevant in your case that the gang purchased guns, that the gang hired lawyers, that the gang apparently had some drug activities of its own during that?
Right. It was important for the conspiracy charge that the gang was involved in supplying guns to its members because the evidence was that Mr. Tejada had a gang or had a drug dealing operation that was under threat from others, as he had threatened other drug dealers with robberies that were committed by him and his co-defendants. Mr. Tejada felt he was under threat from others, and in fact his house had been shot at twice. And in the wake of those shootings, his co-defendants were able to. He was able to reach out to them for protection. He was able to seek out firearms for his protection from his co-defendants. And two of his co-defendants at that point, Malero and Alviar, were occupied roles in the Latin Kings gang of enforcer, which helped corroborate the fact that Alviar and Malero had access to firearms, and indeed there was evidence that they did so. The point about the gang contributing money for the hiring of attorneys, That was a very limited point. It was not argued by the government. There was no implication that these defendants had hired these attorneys with their trial attorneys with gang funds.
Did the Kings, in fact, have their own drug operation as a gang?
There was, Your Honor, there was, I think there was one or two lines in the evidence that referred to the fact that the Latin Kings gang was involved in drug dealing. I think that was obviously not a central point of the case. It was not argued as a central point of the case. But the fact that the Latin Kings were a, as an organization, involved in drug dealing, I think helped perhaps negate any suggestion that the Latin Kings was just some fraternal organization with which these defendants were involved. It was not just not your usual.
But there was no evidence that the Kings took a cut of the profits from this particular conspiracy.
I don't believe there was, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So the district court did properly admit this gang evidence, and it was not an abuse of discretion for it to have done so. The second argument had to do with the racial remarks raised by Mr. Vandergaal's attorney. And I think the district court was, again, made aware of this argument. There was an objection to the use or the playing of these audio tapes with references to racial slurs in them. But as the district court found when confronted with this objection, these defendants were not using them in a sort of racially derogatory way. These were terms that were used almost as terms of endearment among one another. And it was, as the district court found, just in fact the way they spoke to each other. There was nothing racially inflammatory about it. And I suspect, and I, you know, as the case went on and these 189 audio tape recordings or wiretap recordings were played at trial, it became very clear to the jury that this was not any kind of racially inflammatory term and was obviously not played by the government in any kind of attempt to inflame the jury. And the district court found that there was no prejudice to the defendants from not excising those terms. Mr. Vandergaal's attorney also argues that somehow there was a red flag raised by the fact that defendants were charged in telephone counts as well as a conspiracy. But you know, altogether in this case, the jury was properly instructed, the evidence was properly admitted, and there was no error in allowing telephone counts to go to a jury along with the conspiracy count. There's also a spillover argument that was made in that there was a great disparity in the volume of evidence with regard to some defendants as opposed to others. But as the jury verdict in this case demonstrated, the jury was, of course, instructed to consider each defendant and each count separately. And the jury verdict demonstrated that it did so. The jury discriminated among the defendants, for example, coming back with a drug quantity with regard to Mr. Madrigal that was less than with regard to the other defendants, acquitting Mr. Renteria of the conspiracy count, even though he was not a gang member and there was no evidence with regard to him being in the gang. So the jury was not overwhelmed by the gang evidence into convicting somebody of the conspiracy who was not a gang member, and Mr. Delgado Rios, who was also not a gang member, was in turn convicted of being involved in the conspiracy. So the jury verdict demonstrated with regard to each defendant overall that there was no spillover prejudice from the volume or type of evidence introduced at trial. Mr. Delgado Rios' attorney argues with regard to the Agent Camacho testimony, the testimony of Heriberto Rios. But as I understood that the briefs, the objection was to the introduction of a prior consistent statement by Rios through Agent Camacho's testimony on cross. Agent Camacho had been called in the defense case, and the government crossed the agent and introduced the prior consistent statement of Rios to the effect that Delgado Rios had complained about the lesser cut he had received from a drug robbery that he had been involved in. This was not error. This is entirely appropriate. And there was obviously not grounds for reversal there.
Is this case different from the Second Circuit Strother case?
Judge, that's not coming to mind, that case.
Well, with respect to the admission, this statement, as I understand it, they believe this is a prior inconsistent statement, do they not?
I think that's what they said today, but it wasn't inconsistent. Rios had testified for the government on direct that Delgado Rios had complained to him about his share of the drug robbery proceeds. Mr. Delgado Rios' attorney chose not to cross-examine Rios at all with regard to that. Instead, Delgado Rios' attorney called the agent who had interviewed Rios and written a report. Now, that report of the agent did not include, it did not include the statement by Rios that Delgado Rios had complained. And so I think Delgado Rios' tactic at trial was to confine the agent to her report and thus highlight the difference between Delgado Rios' testimony and the interview of Rios. And that's what he did. But then on cross-examination, the government was permitted, and it was quite proper for the government, to elicit from the agent that although her report did not include that statement by Rios, in fact, Rios had indeed said that to her, just was not in her report. And thus that, with the government, elicited the prior consistent statement of Rios.
So your view is the cross-examination sufficed?
Yes. Mr. Valero's attorney argues that here the guilt and drug quantity phases of the trial should have been bifurcated, but it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court not to do that. Obviously, guilt and drug quantity are arguments that blend one into the other, and sometimes the most powerful evidence of guilt, as well as the most powerful evidence of innocence, has to do with drug quantity. And this was not an abuse of discretion for the district court not to have done that. And as Judge Sykes, I think you pointed out, there was no limiting instruction given on this topic, and there was no error here. Finally, with regard to the sentencing issue, with regard to Mr. Tejeda's drug quantity, the district court found that the quantities that the government had proposed in its version of the offense, were credible and based its conclusion with regard to Mr. Lopez's testimony. And obviously that was not clearly a clear error for the district court to have done that, and it reached the drug quantity needed to sentence Mr. Tejeda at the sentence that he got. So if there are no questions, we just ask the court to affirm the sentences and conviction of these defendants.
Thank you, Ms. Fullerton. Mr. Walrath? I mean, you can alter the order of rebuttal if you wish it.
Reiner, if you don't mind.
No, that's right.
I was actually the only person here who was on trial in this case. And I can really address each of the arguments, and I have a few minutes left. I won't address the issue as prior consistent or inconsistent. It's clear if they wanted to show a prior consistent statement, they should have brought Mr. Heriberto Rios back, not the agent. That was clearly hearsay. On bifurcation.
Just on that point, though, Mr. Cooley, how do we review this? There was no objection there, right?
I think that, Your Honor, there were several objections, and there was a motion for a cautionary instruction, and I did everything within reason.
You don't believe it's a plain error situation?
I don't believe it is, but even under plain error, the evidence was closely balanced, not overwhelming. And we went back and forth, redirect and recross, and it was sort of a mess. Your Honor, on bifurcation, there were two written motions filed on bifurcation. If the judge had entertained it, and of course, 841A and 841B are separate. 841A and the elements instruction doesn't even talk about quantity or type of drug. If the judge had given us the okay to draft a bifurcation instruction, we would have done so. But in the instruction conference, he refused to go along with our bifurcation position, just like he refused to issue the instruction that all counsel were court-appointed, which we felt was appropriate.
Let me ask you on this bifurcation issue. How would a district judge, when asked to consider that, what would be the cut point?
Just like a forfeiture judge. When we have forfeitures, we bifurcate that proceeding. It's the exact same situation. And I do believe there's one or two circuits which actually have instructions which pertain to this. But if we had a
What would be the tripwire? Would your position be it should be applied in all drug conspiracy cases?
I think it could be, depending on counsel's argument. In my case, I would have liked to strictly limit my argument in this particular case to buy-sell. But I had to address the conspiracy. If you think he's a member of the conspiracy because of that drug robbery, then I have to talk about quantity. I mean, Mr. Renteria had under 500 grams, and he was actually related to Mr. Tejeda. Well, Your Honor, if you have any questions, as I say, I am familiar with the entire trial, but the defense jointly thanks the court for being so prepared and listening to us and counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Colelli. We do have some more rebuttal time. Ms. Walrath? Walrath?
You want to take advantage of it. Thank you.
I'm sorry for mispronouncing your name, but Walrath is...
That's good enough for me.
I have a home there.
Thank you.
I'm thinking about it.
Thank you.
I'm concentrating on this case now.
To address very quickly, the logic is missing as far as the gang evidence. The link that you would expect, it's already come out, but I want to reinforce it. It would be relevant, wouldn't it, if the Latin Kings were shown to have been benefiting from the Tejeda LVR operation, but there was no evidence. Or that the Tejeda LVR operation was benefiting from the Kings, but there was nothing of that nature either. The implication, the government argues, was that because LVR and Malero at certain points in time were enforcers within the Kings, that somehow that permitted all this other information to come in.
It does seem, though, we have a district judge who tried, certainly sensitive to this issue, as I understand it. I mean, he tried to balance, I think.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think the problem is that the evidence started losing its original purpose and character. I think everybody went in realizing that maybe what was going to happen here is that these defendants were going to be shown to have reason to have known each other. And that was because of their membership in the Kings. But then we get into gang fights, we get into shootings, we get into retaliation. All of this, it's
but
evidence of gang wars.
But once you mention gangs at all in a case, there's never going to be a favorable association, right? I mean, we do allow it if it's relevant and contained, but,
yes,
but those incidents of that you mentioned, wouldn't the average juror be have that focus once gangs are introduced?
Be there, but as the cases we've cited show, at least the court should attempt to alleviate the potential prejudice with an explanatory instruction as to what reason they can consider it for and what reasons they cannot. I know my red light is on.
Did we have, Ms. Walrath, an instruction that you feel was rejected that narrowed it or that was offered to the judge on this issue?
I can't speak to that specifically. I'm not that familiar with the record on that point. I know the red light's on. I just want to say one thing about the racial slur evidence. It was so prevalent in the tape recordings. It doesn't come out in the transcripts. If the court wants to get a sense of how it might affect a jury, I urge that there be a playing of the tape recording themselves. Thank you.
Who has time left? Mr. Zaffaro? You certainly may.
The one point I wanted to make when I was listening to the government's argument is I think they made my point that they indicated that there was no abuse of discretion because quantity is all tied up in guilt, and that's exactly the point, that quantity demonstrates guilt, and it's not supposed to. It's not even an element of the offense. You have these people having to fight it off. So the error was not harmless because quantity proved guilt, and quantity had nothing to do, in fact, with guilt, yet quantity proved guilt. So you have this error which affects rights of self-incrimination, burden of proof, Fifth Amendment due process, Sixth Amendment jury rights, and causes jury confusion. Shouldn't have been.
If we accept that argument, though, then we're bifurcating every drug conspiracy case.
I don't think so. Certainly, I think that's permissible. But I think you look at it on a case-by-case basis, and we actually discussed among ourselves because there is a district court in Pennsylvania that has a procedure that's been used out there for 5 years now where either side can bring a motion, and then the court has to decide, well, do we reach that level of prejudice where we have to do that or not? It's U.S. versus Johns. I can write a supplemental to get that authority to you, but that, right, there is a way to do that, and I think you'd look at it case by case. You don't have to do it every time. We'd like it if you did, but you don't have to do it every time. And you look to see whether you've got that level of prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Daisy, I think your time had expired, but, I don't want to. I've been overruled. Yeah. All right.
With the court,
make it an extra minute for my being overruled.
No, I wouldn't take it, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I wanted to point out for clients listening in internet land that Mr. Alviar has been ably represented by Mr. Davis throughout these proceedings, both in the briefing and in shaping oral argument, and he is present before the court today. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel and, of course, to all defense counsel. An additional thanks for the court for accepting the appointments in this case and for so ably representing all the defendants. Thank you again. The case is taken under advisement.